Hello and welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. Our mission here is to offer hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. What follows is the audio from selected videos posted on Recovering from Religion's YouTube channel. So sit back, relax, and enjoy.
I am so, so happy to introduce Candace Gorham, who she was here a few months ago. She was here with Mandisa, and we absolutely loved having her here, so we couldn't wait for her to come back. And I'm just going to read you a bit of her bio, just so you can all know her a bit better. So Candace Gorham, MA, LPSC, is a licensed professional mental health counselor. She's a former ordained minister and atheist humanist act researcher and writer related to race and religion. She's a member of the Humanist Alliance Advisory Board, the Secular Therapist Project, and the Clergy Project. Candace is also the author of The Ebony Exodus Project, Why Some Black Women Are Walking Out of Religion and Others Should Too. So Candace, thank you so, so much for being here today and welcome.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here. So excited to be here.
It's so good to see you again. I'm glad that you had a good enough experience to come back.
Well, you know, I try. Y'all convinced me to come back, I guess. No.
That big old fruit basket we sent you help out any?
Well, you know, it was tempting. I couldn't resist. So. But yes, I'm excited to be here again, and you know, we'll get ready and go for it.
Yeah, what are we talking about today?
Yeah, I feel like we haven't actually said what it is the topic that we're covering today, but we're going to talk about children's mental health and how we should view it separately from adult mental health, which I feel like this is a mistake that so many of us do, me included, definitely. I feel like we have to definitely consider them as separate, and obviously, like, children deserve so much care, and mental health is something that is so underrated, so underfunded, so just not treated with care at all. So Candace, what would be the best way to start with the topic? What is the first thing that you would approach?
Well, I mean, I've got a PowerPoint slide, so I just will launch straight into the PowerPoint, I guess, if anybody has any early questions or anything, I'll just jump right in.
Let's do it.
All right. So like you said, we are talking about mental health in children. And like you said, we are tempted sometimes to treat children like little adults. And they are not. They are different, and mental health presents different. Mental health, mental illness, behavioral health issues present differently for them. And so as I'm going through this, there may be a lot of information here that you guys are already familiar with. As I was talking to Amaya, you know, sort of planning what we were going to talk about, several of the ideas back and forth, she was like, oh, you know, we've kind of already talked about that. There have been presentations around this. So some of this information you may feel like you've heard before, maybe familiar with. But keep in mind, like I said, the angle is specifically from the perspective of children. And so there are sometimes major differences, and sometimes the differences are shades of gray, which makes it difficult to sort of identify the differences, because they are sometimes it can be difficult to identify why and where and how something might be different between dealing with a child and dealing with an adult. And that little tiny shade of difference can make all the difference in terms of successful outcomes. So we're going to talk about it. We'll move through. I'll kind of move a little bit quickly, I think, through some of the areas that probably are familiar information, and then I'll try to make sure we've got plenty of time for discussion and stuff towards the end. So just a little bit about me, my background, just quickly, my religious background. I was raised as a Jehovah's Witness and through most of my elementary school years when my parents were still together. And then when they separated, sort of floated around and joined in with my dad's, like, the family church, which was United Methodist. And so I got confirmed in the United Methodist Church, and I did Bible study and choir, and, you know, got sprinkled. You know, the Methodists, they don't dunk, they don't dip, they just sprinkle. So I got sprinkled. And then when I got older and got, you know, in high school and college is when I got involved in some of the more serious stuff, just the casting out demons and praying, fasting for, you know, 17 days at a time. And that's when I got involved into that, the more extreme form of Christianity that, you know, really shaped my adult life. But about me personally, I got into mental health as a counselor because of my own struggles with mental health. I started seeing a therapist shortly after I had my daughter. I think I have struggled with mental health issues my whole life. I remember having panic attacks in elementary school. I mean, like, real deal fall out on the floor panic attacks. And so got older, eventually got diagnosed with bipolar 2, slightly different, which is really heavy on the depression side of things. I think what we're most used to seeing when we hear bipolar is we're most more familiar with bipolar 1, which is the mania. You're used to seeing people, you know, running around, jumping off of buildings and stuff like that, you know, the mania side of things. But bipolar 2 is really heavy on the depression end. So that's what I dealt with, and I dealt with, you know, suicidal ideations and that sort of thing. And I'm very open and forthcoming with my struggles with mental health and mental illness and medications and being in and out of therapy and stuff, because, you know, I feel like that's the only way to sort of help people. The best way for me personally, that the best thing that I've been able to, the best way that I've been able to help people is partly through self-disclosure. Just joining and becoming an atheist, it was a very intellectual process for me. It wasn't all about, you know, I'm angry with God. It was a very intellectual process. And then as Amaya pointed out, I'm a member of the Secular Therapist Project, the Clergy Project, the Black Humanist Alliance, and Secular Students Alliance Speakers Bureau. So we went over some of the poll questions, and I was looking at the poll questions. I was kind of surprised that there was the not applicable was pretty high. You guys just don't have any children, I guess. I guess what? Atheists just don't believe in having babies or something. We not Catholics, so we don't have the babies. They have all the babies. I don't know.
We mostly eat the babies.
Oh, that's right. That's what happened. We ate them when we had them. Yeah. I forget. Okay, well, now what were we going to do as far as trying to flip back? So question one is, do you worry or do you know if something might be wrong with the child's mental, emotional, behavior, health? And then whether or not you feel like you have the skills and the knowledge necessary to deal with it.
So I'll go ahead and share the results if you'd like.
Okay. Sure.
So question one, we had 26% yes, 7% or 15% no. No one said, I don't know. And 59% said not applicable.
All right. And then a good percentage, you know, several people had that felt like they had the skills necessary. And then you got 24% not, you know, they don't have the skills necessary or they feel like they don't know. And then I don't know. I think that's interesting, right? Like, I don't know if I got the skills or not. That's a really good, honest answer. It's like, how do I know if I'm doing this right or not? Like, you tell me. That's why I went to a therapist. You know, that sort of thing. That's a good point. And we'll come back and look at the other ones again in a little bit. But the point that I wanted to, you know, make there is, again, it's partly some normalization of the thing, right? I mean, you know, a quarter of the people that we have here, you know, are saying that, yeah, they, you know, they have a child who is, you know, potentially, you know, who is, who does have some issues or potentially has some issues. And then even as the adults, I don't have the skills to deal with this, or I don't know if I'm not even sure if I have the skills to deal with this. So sort of a normalization poll. Respond in the chat, guys. Tamagotchi, is A, a handheld digital pet, B, a type of fruit snack, C, it's bubble tea, or and don't cheat, or D, an app with filters. Don't go Googling what Tamagotchi is.
This is bringing me back to my I don't know how you call it in the US, because we have a different school system, but
well, then don't say nothing.
Anyone else to have them?
Don't say nothing.
What well, are they most saying? People say A.
Most people got a lot of A's.
Yeah, a couple of B's, but mostly A's.
Oh, we got some fruit snacks. Oh, you guys are cute.
We've got a sex toy.
Oh, a sex toy.
That's interesting.
It is a digital handheld digital pet.
These are the overwhelming one. Yeah.
Okay, these are from the 90s. Right. That's what you were trying to say. What it takes you back to your childhood or something like that.
Definitely does. Yeah. Do we know if we can buy this again? Because right now you're taking this craving that I need them back in my life.
I'm sure you can get them online somewhere. Surely. Okay. So true or false? It is appropriate to post on your own Instagram page. True or false? It's appropriate to post on your own Instagram page. True or false?
Mostly true.
One false, mostly true.
False. That is false.
What?
It is not appropriate to post on Instagram page. We'll talk about it. And what I mean is feed. We'll talk about it some more. We'll talk about it. Give me a minute.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
It's appropriate to post on your story. But if you post on your page, on your feed, then you start blowing up your friends' feeds, and then you blowing up their feed. Don't blow up your friends' feeds. Post on your story. Don't blow up your friends' feeds. I'm gonna explain it to you later. Okay. Krabby Patty Pretty Patties can turn you smart, B, into a superstar, C, into your parents, or D, ugly.
I don't know the answer to this one, and I should.
Krabby Patty Pretty Patties. They make you smart, a superstar, into your parents, or ugly.
I'm loving these quizzes. I'm going to make it mandatory well, quizzes back.
What we got?
We have mostly B's. A couple of B's. Quite diverse answers, really. No A's.
Okay. No A's.
Yeah.
Okay. It does indeed make you ugly. We thought, oh my God, they're so cute. They match my purses. But then shortly after you eat a pretty patty, you will start to change colors. And who knows what might happen to you after that. Okay. And last question. What does fear mean? It means A, fuck everything and run, fake everything and anti-regret, or females everywhere are ratchet. What does fear mean?
Ratchet?
Yeah, you know, ratchet. You ain't heard ratchet.
For having a few A's, mostly
couple
A's.
Couple of C's, couple of B's.
Yeah.
So some of everything. Okay. So fear means fuck everything and run.
So, man, I would be doing that before every RFRX.
Okay, so we're going to come back to the quiz in a little bit. Hold tight on that. All right, so some commonly diagnosed in childhood mood disorder. So mood, obviously, you know, these things can be diagnosed in adults. And when we look at mood disorders, I mean, all kinds of mood disorders can be diagnosed at all kinds of ages. There are some disorders that very explicitly should not be diagnosed below the age of 18. It gets under my skin when I see children with certain diagnoses below the age of 18, because that tells me that whoever did that spouses is either inexperienced or very unsophisticated with their diagnostic skills, because it says very clearly in the diagnostics and statistical manual that the certain diagnoses should not happen under the age of 18. But depression, of course, can happen. With kids, when we think about depression, we usually are thinking about crying spells, no energy, isolating yourself. You're thinking about depression as those sorts of things. But with kids, depression might more likely look like irritability, changes in their personality, behavior problems, ADHD. It might look like ADHD. We are quick to throw a child on ADHD medicine when really they might be depressed. And then we're wondering why the ADHD medicine isn't working. So depression, remember, you have a little extra children. And we're going to talk, we'll keep talking about that some more in terms of what to look for. But just keep in mind that depression in children, especially little children, but even with teenagers, depression is not going to quite present the same for them. Because if you think about what depression is a manifestation of the fact that serotonin, dopamine, norepinephrine levels in the brain is changing. Well, if you're a child or a teenager, your brain development is not at the same place that adult brain development is. And therefore, when those brain chemicals are fluctuating, it's going to impact this child brain and behavior differently than the teenage brain and the adult brain. So that's why, the signs and the symptoms are going to be different and they're going to look different. Disruptive mood dysregulation disorder. Bipolar disorder used to get diagnosed left and right. Kids would get diagnosed with bipolar left and right. The diagnostic and statistical manual is very clear. Bipolar disorder should not be getting diagnosed in people under the age of 18 because it requires a certain length of time to ensure that these were patterns. Mania, so it could potentially be ADHD, for example. And so it was very clear we should not be diagnosing children with bipolar disorder. But guess what they were doing? Throwing bipolar disorder on children left and right. So what the doctors, the people who do these things did was for DSM-5, which is what we're working on now, they came up with this set cluster of symptoms and called it disruptive mood dysregulation disorder as a way to capture what we were concerned about with bipolar when we were calling it bipolar. This is what we're capturing. With the recognition that it's really not quite real, genuine bipolar. We can't say that it's real, actual, genuine bipolar disorder yet because they're still a child. So this is what we're calling it right now. It's disruptive mood dysregulation disorder. So there you may see some mania symptoms. You may see some, not getting sleep, extreme depression. You might see some a lot of anger, hostility, more of what you think about when you think about mood swings. That's the sort of thing that you would see with disruptive mood dysregulation disorder. Behavior disorders, oppositional defiant disorder. I used to work at a group home. Oppositional defiant disorder was a common diagnosis that we would see, and I would always explain to the staff that this kid is not the fighter. The kid with ODD, he's not necessarily the one that's fighting. He's not necessarily the one that's destroying property. He's not the one that's, violating rules. But he is talking shit. He is running his mouth. I mean, he is the one that is getting under your skin the most. Out of all the kids, it is the ODD kid that is driving you up the wall because they can be irritable, touchy, annoying, and you are just like, why are you always in such a bad mood? Like, you're a 10, you're 15. The world is not that bad. And so they can be angry, resentful, argumentative, intentionally annoying to other people. They don't accept responsibility. They can be vindictive, like you try to get back at people for nothing, for everything. Now, the conduct disorder one you need to watch for. But conduct disorder, oftentimes, these people can actually grow up to be like sociopaths and stuff like that. And so they actually can be very charming. These kids can be very charming. These kids can be very good at getting what they want and need out of people. But those are the ones that could also be, as you see, aggressive towards people. They're bullying, they're threatening, they're fighting, they're attacking, they're stealing things, they're stealing cars. And, so you don't normally see conduct disorder diagnosed in children. It can be diagnosed below the age of, I think there's two, they have like onset below 10 and above 10. And so rarely do you see it diagnosed below 10. I give side eye anytime I see a diagnosis below 10. Anytime I see a behavior disorder diagnosed for a child that's like elementary school kid, oppositional defiant or conduct disorder, I'm giving it side eye because this is a kid. This is a little child. What do little children do? They have excessive amounts of energy, no impulse control skills. Like, this is what they do. You know, I mean, your behavior really has to be off the wall in order for me to diagnose a little kid with something like oppositional defiant or conduct disorder, you know. But I mean, conduct disorder, these are the ones that are like killing animals and stuff. I mean, these are, you know, they're stealing cars and breaking in. Like, these are the ones, juvenile delinquency. These are the ones that are catching charges and stuff. Let's see. And then intermittent explosive disorder is such an interesting diagnosis because, again, these are kids who they may be sweet as pie all day, every day. I mean, I remember we had this one kid who had intermittent explosive disorder. Everybody loved him to pieces. He was not an irritable kid. He was not oppositional defiant. He was not conduct disorder. But when he exploded, it was explosive. And it could come out of nowhere. Like, you really would be just sitting there and maybe somebody bumped into him, or maybe somebody, you know, took his favorite cup, or, you know, you just never knew. You see there, it says the last bullet point is aggression is out of proportion to the trigger. And it would be this massive tear up the house, knock over furniture, just extreme, extreme explosion. And then, you know, it 15, 20, 30 minutes later, he calms back down and he's back to his normal self. So intermittent explosive really is an interesting diagnosis because you really got to look at what are they like when they're not explosive is just as important as what are they like when they are explosive, if that makes sense. Because in order for that diagnosis to make sense, they've got to be just a normal kid when they're not explosive. Pretty much normal. Like I said, this guy, he was just he was a charming little boy. Like, everybody loved him to pieces. And when he blew up, it was scary. Okay. So developmental disorders. One thing that's really interesting is that with the DSM-5, they moved ADHD to make it a developmental disorder. It was not always a developmental disorder. The idea being that it has to do with brain development. And as your brain, as a child's brain grows and develops and matures, some of those deficits there that contribute to that lack of attention, lack of focus, lack of control, those things will those things will ameliorate themselves over time. They will get better as time goes on because the brain develops. But it's characterized by one of two things, or you might have both, with inattention characteristics or hyperactivity / impulsivity. I am very cautious about giving ADHD diagnoses. I have to really, because they like that they throw out ADHD diagnoses like it's Halloween candy. I feel like every child that I've ever worked with had an ADHD diagnosis. It is not possible that every child that you work with has ADHD, but they throw it out. When you have a real child with actual ADHD, it is a life-changing experience. When you come across an actual child with actually ADHD, it is a life-changing experience because you suddenly realize that there is something different going on. And just, I mean, it's not just regular, like, oh, I got a lot of energy today. I mean, it is different. The level of hyperactivity, the level of impulsivity. My nephew was never diagnosed with ADHD, but he was ADHD. I mean, like, he was, his fidgetiness, I mean, he would chew on his t-shirts, and he couldn't keep t-shirts because he would chew until he like would chew holes through all of the like necks and stuff of his t-shirts. And he was just like, that was his thing. He like was just chewing on stuff. He was like fidgeting. And he would like chew stuff to the point that we had to like, we would just buy him like copious amounts of chewing gum to stop him from chewing stuff. Like that was his fidgety thing, to like chew pencil ends and like chew caps off of sodas. And like, that was his fidgety thing, was to just chew. And it was like, stop chewing shit. Like, you're gonna choke on something. And anyway, don't let me get on him chewing on shit. I'm traumatized by how much he chewed on shit. He was like a damn dog chewing on. Anyway, sorry. I forgot my professionalism for a moment.
You're doing great, Candace.
ADHD. ADHD. So, spectrum disorder. Of course, this is pretty hard to diagnose. This requires a lot of, you know, I have never even pretended that I was going to try to diagnose autism. I don't feel like that's something that even should be diagnosed. Like, just in a regular office setting, I think that they need, this should go through some actual testing. If you take your child to a therapist and they're just a regular LPC therapist or a licensed social worker therapist, and they want to say, oh, your child has autism, let's write down autism, you need to insist on some testing. We need to get some psychological testing, some neuropsychological testing. You need to get something. This is not just a sit down with the DSM manual and check off some things and then, and voila, he's got autism. Because again, this is a developmental thing, right? Some of the issues could be something that the child could, you know, grow out of or something like that. Like, there are, it can be, because people can be so high functioning with autism as well. That is just something that I as a clinician myself, I just don't try to do any diagnosis with that one. Now, I will work with somebody that has sufficient cognitive functioning, you know, that we can work together, but I don't even try to pretend that I can diagnose somebody with autism, just because I feel like they need testing and they need a lot of a lot needs to go into ensuring that that's what it actually is. And then intellectual developmental delay is just sort of a catch-all term to say, okay, maybe they don't quite fit these categories, but something is definitely going on. And it's characterized, as you can see, it says, by deficits in either their reasoning skills, planning, judgment, abstract thinking, academic. It could just be academic. They could be fine in every other character, but they are IDD, and their deficit is in, you know, language or something like that. So IDD works, you could say that they could be, you know, it could be very, very specific. And it says down there that the IQ below 70, but they also have, you can also get what they would call like a borderline diagnosis, which would be, you know, somebody might be like, their IQ might be like 80 or something like that, because, you know, low normal is 90. So if you're, so somebody at about 80 might be considered like borderline IDD, because it's a little below, but not quite the 70 mark. And then you got your anxiety disorders. A lot of times we see a lot of post-stress disorder, which for kids, they can have a lot of the same symptoms as adults. I think that for the kids that I've worked with, I don't see a lot of flashbacks. What you would see with kids with post-traumatic stress disorder, though, is, especially with little kids, what you want to look for is their play. Like when they're playing, how are they playing? Are they, if they were in a car accident, is their play about car accidents? Are they playing out car accidents all the time? You know, maybe they've got, you know, fake cars, and they're playing. Or what if, you know, them and their friends are playing in the yard and they're like, oh, we're on bikes, let's pretend we're getting in a car accident or something like that. And even in their mind, they may not realize that that's what they're doing. But if that's what, you know, you pay attention to that thing and see what was their trauma, and see if that theme of that trauma is part of their play. That tends to happen a lot with post-traumatic stress, especially with small children. Whatever that trauma was, it will come up repetitively in their play. So they may not necessarily have the flashbacks. They may not necessarily, you know, have those intrusive symptoms, but they may have a repetitive play. Definitely the avoidance, you know, you might see that where they would, you know, have anxiety about getting back in a car again, you know, or, you know, something like that. You definitely could see that. The arousal and the reactivity, you know, that has to do with like paranoia, you know, being afraid that, their arousal, that's basically a type of paranoia, essentially. Now this one, separation anxiety, that is definitely something that you're going to see in children. Of course, you know, pretty much most of these other diagnoses can be, most of these other things can be diagnosed in any age range. But separation anxiety is pretty much almost always going to be something that you're going to see with children. And it is, as you see, the recurrent excessive distress when anticipating or experiencing separation from home or major attachment figures. So it could be parents, you know, it could be, you know, whoever are the guardians. Or again, it could just, I don't like to leave the home, you know, home is something about home is a safe place. And separation anxiety, there may not necessarily be anything traumatic that triggered that thing. Like it maybe not necessarily like I was in a car accident, that's why I want to be stuck to my mama all the time. That is just the anxiety disorder in and of itself. It's just the, I don't want to be separated from my, or from, you know, whoever. And you see, you know, they're worried, they're preoccupied with something significantly scary and untoward is going to happen, right? Somebody's going to die. Somebody's going to get kidnapped. Somebody's going to be in an accident. There's the physical complaints when they're separated, I think is an interesting one that, you know, as soon as you leave, oh, I got a stomach ache, I got a headache, I got something is always wrong. I had a teenage client actually who had some separation anxiety issues from her mom. And she would have stuff like that. She would get sick. She would have headaches, and you know, she just became miserable just in so many ways. And she had so much, you know, she would be just so worried constantly whenever her mom wasn't home. And so even though it was, you know, 16, 17 years old, she would experience that separation anxiety from her mom. There was definitely some issues there, some that I think contributed to that, but she could qualify for, you know, what we call here the separation anxiety. Just as sort of like a funny little story in terms of like worrying about the death. Some people may know on here may know that I'm an avid hiker. I go hiking all the time, almost every Sunday. And one time I went hiking at this place, and there are these, it's like, oh gosh, I don't know how many stairs. I literally have tried to count all the stairs one time to the top. And I think I've gotten to probably 600, 700, something like that. And I always like lose count. And one time I was coming down, and this little boy, he could talk, but he could barely talk. I mean, couldn't have been any more than like 5 years old. And he was with his dad, and everything was, he's talking about the mountain, but everything was, and you could die. And he was like, he'd be like, yeah, you got to be careful with these stairs because you could fall down the stairs and die. And his dad was like, yeah, but I got you, buddy. I got you. You're going to be okay. And he'd be like, okay. Because look at the edge. If you look over that edge, it's like if you look too close, you could fall over the edge and die. And this dude is like, I know it is steep, but it's okay, buddy. I got you. It's going to fall. Okay, Dad, be careful. Oh, there's a rock. Like, be careful, because if you stumble over that rock, you could fall off the side of the mountain and die. I mean, I was behind this little boy, his dad, for like 7 or 8 minutes. And I swear that little boy found like 7 or 8 death scenarios. And it got to the point that you could tell the dad was embarrassed, because like at one point he looked back at me and kind of like let out that little embarrassed laugh. It was like, I'm sorry. He was like, do you want to go around? And, you know, I ended up going around them, and I tried to stop and talk to the little boy for a second or whatever. And like, as I kept going, he found another reason that they were going to fall off the side of the mountain and die. Like, so that's a funny example, just this sort of extreme preoccupation with like, we're going to die in some kind of way. Panic disorder is not really something that I see a whole lot with children. I would see the post-traumatic stress and the separation anxiety, but panic disorder, you may get with your teenagers. You know, they're old enough that they may start to have panic attacks. I think that little kids seem to deal with fear differently, than we do when we start to get older. They may have what you might call a panic attack for a kid may just be a crying spell, you know, or may just look like a temper tantrum or something like that. Maybe that might be a sort of a panic attack, but what we call a panic attack, a clinical panic attack, you know, we don't really see that a whole lot with kids. I haven't. This sort of thing, I've seen it with teenagers for sure. We talked some more. Let's see the other poll. We looked at the second one. I think we looked at that when it was up there. Do you have a
chance? You want me to go ahead and share it?
You can pull it back up. I think we did it though, but you can pull it back up. Yeah.
Yeah, so here it is. So we have 11% said yes.
That's right. This was question number three, right? Mm-hmm. Do you have a child? Yeah.
24% said no. 17% said, I don't know. And almost half of the people said not applicable. And this is to the question, do you feel you have the skills / knowledge necessary to attend to your child's mental, emotional, or behavioral health?
And then, number three is, this one was, do you have a child who has mental health, behavioral health diagnosis? And so we've got, then say, had two on poll one had two items, and poll two has, right? Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry about that.
No. I was confused on my own. I had confused myself for a second there. But we've got about 20% who said, yes, they know for sure. Then we still, got all y'all out there who I'm so jealous of, who it's just like not applicable. I'm jealous, but I don't know, maybe. Like, I'm trying to get rid of my child. She's a senior. Soon I'll be free. So this, here we go. You got your teenagers.
My teenage self feels very personally attacked by this society.
you are attacked, okay? You are. We all are. All right, so medications. We want to look at those quickly. These are medications that I have most often come across with kids. Again, of course, there are tons more antidepressants out there, mood stabilizers out there. Prozac and Zoloft seem to be the two that I've come across the most with kids that I've seen the most. Even when I'm reviewing other records, not just kids that I personally work with, but reviewing records, it just, those two seem to be the ones that come up the most. I think, I don't know if they're just such old ones. They've been around long enough that, they're tried and true. And then bupropion as well. I see that actually more often than I expected. I do see it. And then mood stabilizers and antipsychotics. These are more like for your really aggressive kids. You're going to see this Risperdal and Seroquel. I see those a lot. Now, the Thorazine, that is either your children who are having, like hallucinations, they're having hallucinations, they're having some kind of psychotic episode, they're having delusions, they're having those sort of things, or they're often just really aggressive. Because these medications will slow you way down. And so they will give these medications to children who are very aggressive. Those conduct disorder boys that we were talking about earlier, those intermittent explosive boys we were talking about earlier, you will see them on all sorts of Risperdals and Seroquels especially. I've only had a couple of kids that I worked with who were on Thorazine, and they needed it. And I mean, they needed it. And I do not recommend Thorazine hardly for anybody, because it turns you into a zombie. And I mean, these boys needed it. They needed it as a regular medication, and then they also had it as a PRN. Like as an additional as needed dose, and it still wasn't enough. I was trying to get them on injection forms. They were that aggressive. And they were big stocky dudes that were just like, they were just too, we couldn't control them. And so, but anyway, Risperdal and Seroquel, if you got any kids that they want to, that you're doctors or therapists or whatever recommend Risperdal or Seroquel, you definitely want to have a good long conversation with them about those. They're good. I mean, they're good for aggression, but they will slow you way down, and they are powerful antipsychotics. So they will get the job done if you're trying to take the edge off of some aggression, though, for sure. So anti-anxiety medications, ones that are beginning to be, doctors are sort of prescribing more and more now, are these two, then long-acting ones, the hydroxyzine, which is the brand names are Vistaril and Atarax, or Buspirone, or which is brand name is Buspar. These are long-acting. They're not addictive. In fact, hydroxyzine, I call it the grandfather of Benadryl. It's actually an antihistamine that they use as an anti-anxiety medication. And I've seen it used a lot with kids for sleep. Small kids even. It's, again, like I said, it's essentially, I've seen it used for literally for allergies. It is the grandfather of Benadryl. It was here before Benadryl was here. So it is old. It is tried and true for many purposes. So that is not a very scary medication if your child has a lot of issues with anxiety or not sleeping well or anything like that. Now, the ones, of course, that we know of, that we hear a lot of, are Ativan, Klonopin, Xanax. I got a line through those because I don't recommend those for anybody. They are extremely addictive. They are highly abused. Let me rephrase that. I'm not saying I don't recommend those for anybody. What I mean to say is I recommend extreme caution. I think that you definitely need to have a nice long conversation with your prescriber with those. They work great for panic attacks, for people who have extreme anxiety issues. I just have seen so many issues with addiction. I mean, especially with Klonopin. I've had so many of my clients swear up and down to me that they are not addicted to Klonopin. And I'm like, you are addicted to Klonopin. And more and more, especially where I am in North Carolina, it's getting harder and harder and harder to get their class of medication is benzodiazepines. You may hear just benzos. In North Carolina, it is getting harder and harder and harder to get a doctor to prescribe benzos. They are just getting away from it because they're so abused and they go for so much on the streets. But in terms of prescribing them for children, I don't see that happen very often. And so if that does come up as something potential for children or your child or your teenager, that's definitely a slow way down. And let's talk about this really long and hard with our prescriber if that comes up as a potential medication for you. And then we got stimulants and non-stimulant medications for ADHD. Got your amphetamines and your methylphenidate varieties, basically, which are Adderalls and Vyvanse, Concertas, Ritalins. These are the most popular ones that you'll see as stimulants, which, amphetamines, these are literally like related to cocaine. So, this is very serious. Significant medication to be putting your child on. So you got to take that into serious consideration. Now, again, for a child with true ADHD, stimulants do the job. They should work. There's a very real brain development reason why they should work. Because the way I explain it to children is there's a little area on your brain that is just not turned on. And if you take this medicine, this little bit of medicine will turn that area on for you. And that helps you. And what's happening is the problem, the reason why you're so hyperactive is because your body is trying to turn that little bitty tiny area of your brain is trying to turn it on. That's why you're so hyper, is your body's trying to turn that area of your brain on. But this medicine, since this medicine will turn that area of your brain on for you, then you, your body gets to calm down now because it doesn't have to work to try to turn that little area of the brain on. So your body can calm down because the medicine is doing the work for you. That's kind of how that's my super over the top, way super simplified explanation that I kind of use for children. Because you would think, why do I want to give a stimulant to a hyperactive child? And that is what you're doing. You're stimulating an area of the brain that is not stimulated enough. And so that is why for somebody like, so then you hear like, well, why do people take Adderall and then they get all this energy? That's because that area of their brain is not turned off. They're just fine. Have ADHD. Therefore, they don't need the medicine, which is why some kids don't respond to the medicine. They just end up being turned up more. They end up getting aggressive. They end up being more hyperactive. If you put your child on a stimulant medication and they're just more turned up, they're more aggressive, they're more all these other things, they may not need the stimulant medication. I see that quite often, actually, working with my teenage kids, which is why they also have some non-stimulant varieties of medications as well. And then you got your black box warning here. And this is so important because so much medication is developed and our trials are put or run on adults. We don't run medication trials on children. And so then we have all this medication that we're giving to children. You know, a lot of the antidepressants and stuff like that. I mean, I'm not saying they don't do any trials on children, but a lot of these antidepressants, stabilizers and antipsychotics and stuff, the trials were not run on children. They were run on adults. And then we're going, oh, but I bet we can use these on children. We're treating children like they're little adults and not children. And so they're taking these medicines and they're giving them to children. And then we're finding out, oh, wait, it's not as great for them as we thought. So almost all medication like antidepressants and mood stabilizers and stuff are considered boxed warning when it comes to children because of the potential to increase suicidal ideations and that sort of thing for children. So anytime you put your child on a mental health medication, like that, you just immediately need to assume that you got to watch out for increase in suicidal ideations. Just off gate, just assume that you need to be looking out for that, unfortunately. And then, okay, so we had the poll. Do you have a child who's taking any medication?
Question number 4, do you have a child who now or used to take medication or mental or behavioral health problem?
Mm-hmm. So we've got
20% say yes, 28% said no, only 4 said I don't know, and another 48 were not applicable.
So some common interventions that we see, cognitive behavior therapy is about as straightforward as they come. You're going to see cognitive behavior therapy everywhere. Family therapy, of course, with children, they have different models of family therapies, different types, but family therapy in general. You just can't get away from family therapy, guys. Kids are taken care of by adults. Adults need to know what to do. So I'm going to talk about that some more. Stick a pin in it, family therapy. Applied behavioral analysis is something that's done with especially with kids with autism. Collaborative problem solving, I'm gonna come back to that. That's my favorite. And then just community-based interventions are getting more and more popular, where we're actually taking it out of the office and putting the therapist where the kids are and working with them in their natural environment. So working with them in home, working with them in the schools, that sort of thing. And then resiliency-based models, where again where we're trying to help the child, because children are dependent on the adults that they have in their lives. And if they have adults in their lives, you know, you got to help learn how to survive in the environment that they have. So then we focus on helping them build their resilience. So you have models that's what they focus on. And then the last one, I think this was the last one. If you throw that back up there one more time, do you have a child who is or has been in therapy?
And we have 28% said yes, 20% said no, 2% weren't sure. And half of the people said, hey, this doesn't apply.
Mm-hmm. Okie dokie.
I suspect there may be a lot of folks in the audience here who just don't have kids like myself.
Mm-hmm. All right. So we talked some earlier about, okay, what kind of things to watch for. And of course, some of the things that we know, you know, that makes sense, right, are, okay, some grades are getting bad, they're moody, you know, the loss of interest in just everything, whatever, anything, not paying attention to your hygiene if suddenly you're not bathing and washing and taking care of yourself. Mania being things like not sleeping, excessive energy, excessive energy. I'm trying to think of off of the top of my head. More things will come to me in a second as I'm talking. I'll keep thinking of mania symptoms. Crying spells, these are things that we think of, right? Panic attacks. A symptom of mania is like irresponsibility, but irresponsibility specifically like things like not managing your money well. Have you guys ever seen that commercial where I think it's like a Vraylar commercial or something. It's a medication commercial. And they show the woman like ordering stuff online, and she orders all this. She's just like buying all this stuff. And they show like the next day where she's sitting there and she's got like three cameras, like three of the same camera, and all these boxes are like clothes. So once she's come out of her episode, she's realizing I've spent all my money on like stuff that I don't need. So that spending your money on hypersexuality can be a thing for some people. Those are signs of mania. So some of the less obvious signs, things to think about. What about the changes in the style of their dress? You know, what if your child was previously a very trendy child and then suddenly they don't, you know, they only want to wear giant sweats and, you know, or what it could be completely the opposite. Maybe suddenly they become extremely concerned about their appearance and they're extremely, you know, they're very controlling over every single detail. You know, that could be a concern. Like why this, you know, trying to control every single detail of every single thing. So it could be one of two extremes. Sudden hyperfocus or lack of focus. It could be, again, extremes. You're looking for extremes. Changes in their interest. I was in marching band. I play an instrument, but suddenly I'm not interested in playing my instrument anymore, you know, or I like video games, but now I'm not interested in playing video games anymore. You know, just sudden, and, you know, and there may be some sorts of changes where you think, oh, that's a good thing, right? Like, oh, he's not interested in playing his video. He's playing his video game less. Oh, that's a good change. But be careful, you know, pay close attention to that. Like, why are you suddenly not as interested in playing your video game? That was something that used to bring you joy. And now suddenly you're not interested in doing the thing that brings you joy. You know, you got to ask yourself, you need to be, as the parent, you know, or caregiver or aunt or uncle or whatever, you know, need to be paying attention, thinking of it from that perspective. Nightmares, of course, it might not just be a scary movie that they watched, you know, what else is going on. Sleep disturbance is easy for us with teenagers and smartphones for them to be staying up late and to think that that's, oh, you just need to take the phone away from them. But, you know, if they say you got a child who generally sleeps fine and now all of a sudden they're up all the time or they're sleeping all the time, you know, you again, it's all about changes in patterns and extremes. Oops, sorry. And then loss of friends. So it's a big deal, you know, or changes in their peer is also a big deal because, you know, if we were talking about, remember, one of our things was the behavior disorders. When we talked about conduct disorder being having to do with, you know, all conduct disorder being like those kids get into like juvenile delinquent behavior. So changing your peer group can be a big issue as well. When you are stressed, depressed, or in a mood, but are trying to hide it, what is something that someone who knows you would notice if they were paying attention? So be thinking about that, because what I'm thinking about is, you know, little things, right? Because we all get stressed and depressed and, you know, but we still go on every day, right? And so to a certain degree, when we can hide it. But the people who know us best, if they're paying attention, might be able to pick up on subtle changes in our behavior. So kind of think through that. What are maybe some of the little things that you know you do differently or that might change with you or that might shift with you that are sort of subtle things that the people who know you would be able, should be able, could pick up on if paying attention, but maybe everybody else might not pick up on.
I've seen that before.
You have?
No, I have never seen that before.
Oh, you haven't?
Oh, oh man.
Something to feel the void. Sometimes you just need a little sign.
Yeah, I didn't realize I've got like a packing peanut size hole in my soul.
Right, exactly. Feel the void. Challenging behavior. So we're dealing with these kids. Kids have these challenging behaviors sometimes. And sometimes mental health issues, a lot of times with kids, as we see, most of the time with kids, challenging there for kids, mental health issues oftentimes present as challenging behaviors, depression, irritability, grumpiness, da 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 da. You know, we're trying to get them to do things. Imagine for us, right? When we are depressed, we don't want to go to work. We don't want to do this. We don't want to do that. But the same thing might be happening with your child. They're depressed. They don't want to go to school, but we're forcing them to go to school. That becomes a fight. That becomes an argument, blah, 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 blah. So when children are having their issues, a lot of times challenging behaviors that we're dealing with may be from some, you know, so we're looking at challenging behaviors. But another thing, challenging behaviors can occur when a demand is placed upon someone, when a demand placed upon someone requires skills to handle the demand in an adaptive manner that the person does not fully possess. Let me say that one more time. So challenging behaviors occur when a demand placed upon someone requires skills to handle the demand in an adaptive manner that the person does not fully possess. Another way, lagging skills plus expectations equals challenging behaviors. You don't have some kind of skill, or you haven't developed the skill yet, it's not well developed yet, plus some expectation put on you, you're gonna have a challenging behavior. That's just what it is often. So could it be lagging skills, or are they just hard-headed or good at manipulating? Like, you know, a lot of times that's something I hear a lot when I would talk to parents with their kids. Oh, he's such a good manipulator. Oh, he's good at manipulating. You got to be careful. They're manipulating. What do you think about it? You could play a good hand poorly or a poor hand well, but you can't help the hand that you're dealt, right? So if you don't have certain skills, you can't help that. or if you're born with a brain that's going to be an ADHD brain, you can't help that. I was born with a bipolar brain. I can't help. You know, there's certain things you can't help that, but I can control how I play the hand that I can control how I play the hand and I'm dealt, right? Now, if you think about, though, with children, consequences only work on skills that a child already has. These, what I'm talking to you guys about are, and I forgot to say this, I didn't put a little cue in here to remind myself to say this, but these are little tenets and bullet points from collaborative problem solving. So collaborative problem solving was one of those models that I mentioned earlier. And so these are some of the things that come out of that model. So collaborative problem solving as a model was developed by these two doctors out of Harvard University and blah, 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 blah. But collaborative problem solving as a treatment model, not just, solving problems collaboratively. No, like an actual treatment model called. It talks about working on lagging skills and that being the explanation for challenging behaviors and things that look like mental health issues. And so one of the points that they make is, okay, you can give your kid consequences all day long, right? But if they don't have the skill to do the thing that you're asking them to do, then it's not going to work, right? You can consequence me to death, but I am not going to be able to come up with the necessary calculations to help you get the next space probe into space. I do not have the skills. So, beat me till I'm black and blue, I'm not going to be able to perform those calculations. And so it's the same sort of thing. If a kid has ADHD and, it is difficult for them to sit still. You can beat them till they're black and blue, but you expect them to sit still in a classroom in a chair for 2 hours without getting up, without talking, without saying anything, without having a break. You're going to lose this battle. You know, it's just not going to work. Another CPS collaborative problem solving mantra is that there's every behavior is behind every behavior is a good explanation. There's a good explanation there. You just kind of have to slow down to find out what that explanation is. And then one of my favorite things to keep in mind is that if the child was really good at manipulating, they wouldn't be getting caught. They wouldn't be getting in trouble and wouldn't be in therapy in the first place. Right. Our best manipulators are people good manipulators don't get caught. Or they don't get caught until they've been successful at manipulating for a long time, right? They've been manipulating people. By the time you realize that somebody's been manipulating you, you look back and you like, damn it, they've been manipulating me for the past year. You don't realize that a good manipulator has been manipulating you the first time that they manipulate you. And so when I hear people saying that their child is a good manipulator, it's like, they might be trying, but if you can say that they are doing it, not very good at doing it. So I did all that talking about medication and stuff. So are we going to use medication or not? Pills don't teach those skills, but they do make it more possible to learn. So you might have to, give that some serious thought.
I love that. Can you say that a little louder for the folks in the back?
Oh, say it for the people in the back. So pills don't teach skills, but they do make it more possible to learn. Yes.
That's beautiful. I really love that.
It's, better living through chemistry. I believe in it all day long. If you are the parent that is very anti-medication or very skittish about medication or very concerned about medication, I get it. I understand. And I just got through saying a minute ago, right? Like, be very cautious about these medications. But if your child is not functioning in life, and there are medications that could potentially help, you need to have some serious conversations with your prescriber and with your child's therapist about the potential risks and benefits. You just might want to have a serious consideration of this thing. Because again, if you think about like with ADHD, sometimes there are real biological reasons why these things are happening. And if that pill can help turn on that little dot area of my brain to just make it a little bit easier for me so that I don't have to struggle through this too, on top of all the other struggles, then, you know, maybe that little thing will help. You know, just as a person who was very anti-medication for a while because of my religious beliefs, and I went back and forth with medication for quite a while because of my religious beliefs, and I wanted to have faith and trust and believe. Once I finally was like, you know what, I need this medicine. I gotta have this medicine. It's making my life so much better. I wouldn't be the person that I am today without my pills. I believe in them. I love them. We got a great relationship. I would not be the person that I am today had I not decided when my daughter was four, that's what it was. I was just in a deep depressive episode. My daughter was four, and I realized I cannot be here for her the way that I need to be here for her. And at that time, I still was not committed to my medication. But what I said was, I will take this medication at least until she graduates from high school. And when she graduates from high school, I can revisit whether or not I want to be on medication. But until then, I have to be here for my child, and I have to be here. And I can't be here without this medication right now. And I've been on medication ever since. And since then, I've since decided, like, no, better living through chemistry. So keep that in mind when you're considering medication, or before you, you know, just completely take that off of the list of potential help for you and your child.
Candace, sorry, I hate to interrupt you, but just to let you know, we're going a little bit over the time. So we have about 10 minutes left. Is that okay?
That's fine. Thank you. Okay, so that's fine. I got a little bit of section that I want to make sure that I talk about. So disciplining in the home, spanking. I don't believe in spanking. It's violence against children, which I imagine a lot of people here probably say the same thing. Think about children like structure. Why do they tattletale on each other? Because they insisting on structure and adherence to rules for everybody else, right? That's why they're tattletaling. So therefore, children do like structure. Laissez-faire is not a parenting style. It's very easy for us as free thinkers to sort of feel like, oh, we want to, you know, let our children, we want to teach them to be free, you know, free thinkers too, and critical thinking. And in order to let them be critical thinkers, we got them think for themselves. Yeah, well, don't run away with yourself now, because laissez-faire is not parenting. It's neglect. You still got to get in there and be a parent. I'm going to say that one more time for the people in the back. If you're considering seeking a therapist, a lot of times I get the question, should I tell my therapist that we're a non-religious family? Obviously, that's a choice you got to make, but a good therapist would want to know that. A good therapist should want to know that. So whether or not you feel comfortable telling up front, that's up to you. But just keep in mind that a good therapist would want to know that. That is important information. You know, it matters. It helps in terms of conceptualizing your client and your client family as a whole group, especially if you're going to be doing family therapy. Inquire about the therapist's theoretical orientation. Is it evidence-based? Don't be afraid to ask off gate. Do you do an evidence-based model? You know, what's the research? Is it science-based? The therapist is not your babysitter. Do not drop your child off at 7, 8 p.m. and then decide you're going to go get dinner and you'll be back at 8 or 7:50, the therapist is not your babysitter. You need to be an active participant in your child's therapy. Now, there are times when, of course, they're going to say you don't, you know, your child's going to want to have their own individual sessions and you're not going to be in the room, but you need to be present. You even need to be sitting in the lobby, because there have been times where wanted to go out into the lobby to go get the parent and the parent wasn't there. And I had something, you know, the child was ready to talk to the parent about something and the parent wasn't there. The parent ran to the store real quick. The child, the therapist is not your babysitter. Even if you're not in the room, you are part of the therapy. You need to be there at all times, waiting and sitting and prepared. So from a therapist, don't drop your child off and leave them there. I'm not your babysitter. You need to be here. Okay, so dealing with family. Don't let you got other people in the family that want to probably help in and jump and discipline. Make sure you tell them how you feel and what you do and what you don't do. And if they can't respect it, then they can't be part of the disciplining process. I went through it with my daughter's grandmother on the other side of the family. It got ugly. Long story short, it got ugly. And even if you're not out to your family about, you know, not being a believer, or, you know, you can still be upfront with them about the behavior interventions that you use, and then educating your family and educate and especially your child, you know, about mental illness, about their condition, about the medication that they're on, about the evidence-based model that they're using, you know, educating the child, be real with them. Don't just say, you know, hey, take this pill. You take this pill at 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. What is this pill? The child should be able to name their medication. They should be able to tell you what their pill is for. When I worked in the group home, that was part of the boys' goals. They had to all be able to name what pills they were on. They had to be able to look at them and identify them. Like, that was one of the things. So your child should, I mean, even a 5 or 6 year old should be able to tell you what medicines they're taking and what they're doing. Like, involve your whole family in this process if you're getting therapy. And be collaborative, of course, collaborative problem solving. So we'll talk back about the quiz, children and teens live in a world that's different from ours. They have different interests and capacities, mental illness, children, teens, different from adults. Okay. We don't immediately understand the kids, but we can. They have their own worlds. They have their own language, but we can learn it. They sense to us, but they want us to be there for them nonetheless. So about that one thing that was so funny about the the Instagram, was it Instagram?
Yeah, the Instagram.
Right. So this is what my daughter told me. Okay, this is what my almost 17-year-old daughter told me, is that this is the rule apparently amongst teenagers. And this is what I was told when I first got my own Instagram, was like, please don't do this. This is rude. Because like I said, when you post in your feed like that, then it posts on your friend's feed. And therefore you are blowing up your friend's feed. And that is rude and disrespectful to your friend's feed. So therefore you should only be posting on your story, because that does not interfere in their friend's feed. That's what I was told.
I've never heard this before in my life.
Well, now you know. Okay, there you go. Don't post on your own feed. You cannot even post on your own feed. This is what I was told. My daughter was like, please don't be posting on your feed. I was like, why can't I post on my feed? You're going to be blowing up your friend's feed. Or your timeline or whatever.
I'm like one of those cremated old ladies. You know, you just add water and you've got an Instagram. It's just that's just super. Don't quite get it. I don't understand the whole thing yet.
Exactly. I don't even use it. I should, but I don't.
Sounds great. Thank you so much, Candace. That was really, really good. It was really detailed. And I love how you went through like each diagnosis and like getting really, really specific into like the mental health issues that our children could potentially have. I feel like I was reading the symptoms and I was like thinking that was me when I was a teenager, but obviously not trying to diagnose myself at all. It's just that, it brought me back. We do have a couple of questions. So if you're okay with it, I'm just going to go and ask.
Okay.
So the first question is, what do I tell my child who has been told that they are going to go to hell by their playmates?
Oh, gosh. What do you tell your child who's been told that they're going to go to hell by their playmates? I think that so my daughter, that happened to my child. We just talked about it. That was all that really we could do. We just talked about it. I explained to her why that made sense to that child. I explained to her the sort of the religious belief behind, I said, well, this is, I obviously assuming that I knew what the child's religion was. So it was a little black kid that, live in the neighborhood. So, of course, I'm making my assumptions. I know what they believe, right? So I say, this is what the Bible says, and so if you believe the Bible, this is what you believe. And so I just sort of broke it down like that and said, if you believe the Bible, then, this is what you would believe about a person. And then we had a conversation about, do we believe, the Bible to be a true thing? And, and we kind of had some more conversation about at that stage in her life, I had not quite said to her, like, you're an atheist or I'm an atheist or, like the Bible is not, like, we had not had a very explicit discussion like that. I was still kind of letting her sort of feel some of that stuff around herself. But we had multiple conversations about the Bible to the point that she had already kind of come to the decision that the Bible didn't make sense. And, it wasn't a very accurate book and it wasn't the kind of book that you wanted to refer to for any kind of actual guidance in life. When you looked at it, look at the advice that it gives people. There's this horrible advice that it gives people. Like, that was kind of how I would kind of went through it. Like, this is what the Bible says, but look at this advice that it gives people. No, this is how I tell. So is this the kind of book that you want to refer to? And so once the Bible became sort of like discredited in her eyes, and then I was able to explain to her, well, this is where this idea comes from. It comes from this book. Then it was kind of like, okay. And then she was able to just kind of be like, well, that's stupid. That doesn't make any sense. So then what we had was a conversation around, well, do you still want to be friends with this person now? So she was able to get past the hell part pretty quickly because she had already discredited the Bible. And then the next conversation was, do you still want to be friends with a person who would say this sort of thing to you? And so then we had to have more conversation about that because this was kind of a girl that she had a love-hate relationship. This was a frenemy. Anyway, and they were back and forth. They would be friends one day and not friends the next. And so she kind of ended up, she was able to stay friends with the girl, but she knew that it was, it kind of helped her put her friendship with the girl in a different, it put friendship in a different place. And she's from there, she started realizing like, okay, this really is a different person and I really do need to treat this friendship differently.
Well, we've got another question. One or two more. This, I think, is a good one. Do you know of any connection between nutrition and behavioral issues? And if you do know of some connection, what's that connection? Tell us about it.
Well, one thing that is not a connection is sugar doesn't make you hyper. I don't think that that's a real thing. I think that we've decided as psychiatrists, when they're prescribing ADHD medications, have I've heard enough psychiatrists tell their parents that no, sugar is not making your child hyper. You know, so that's something I've heard plenty. But no, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm not like a nutritionist or anything, so I don't know of anything specific. But, you know, obviously I would say I think that, you know, healthful eating is essential, right, to just everything, right, to any kind of being balanced, being stable for, you know, if you, especially for kids. I mean, you're thinking about they're growing, they're changing. And they're going through growth spurts. They need calories. They need vitamins. They need, and so if they are, say, for example, if they're not getting enough food, if they're going through a growth spurt and they're not getting enough food, and something as simple as just being hungry, you know, that's going to trigger, you know, irritability. I mean, that could trigger irritability in me and you. But imagine now you're triggering irritability in somebody who doesn't have the skills to deal with that irritability. We have the skills to deal with that irritability. We've lived long enough to learn how to compensate. But now you're dealing, it's like a baby, right? When the baby gets hungry, they don't know anything else but to cry. So I think that obviously there's certain basics, there's certain foundational things that we just know to be true, right? That you got to eat enough, and we know that healthy eating is better than not, you know, than just eating, you know. I mean, I can't think of any specific you know, research or knowledge or anything right off the top of my head, but you know, I mean, I definitely say that when I work with my clients, when I work with my families, the things that I inquire about the most are you eating and are you sleeping and are you drinking? Are you staying hydrated? I ask about those things every session, every time, all the time. Have you been eating? Have you been sleeping? Are you staying hydrated? To the point that they get tired of me. They start answering the question before I even ask. Yes, I ate yesterday. You know, or like, especially my clients that are really depressed, when I have clients who I know have it, who don't, you know, who don't eat sufficiently, or maybe I know that they'll live off of crackers or whatever. And it's like, that's not gonna get it for you.
Yeah, that is part of self-help, isn't it? Or like self-care more so.
Right.
Making sure that your basic needs are covered, which, right, we so often forget. Like, I know I'm terrible with sleeping. Other people are terrible with eating. So, yeah, mm-hmm. Make sure you take care of yourself, because it's super, super important. And we neglect it so much. So thank you, Candace. That makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. So then the last question we have, unless someone else sends us another one in the next 5 minutes, is how early can OCD manifest? Or, I mean, this particular person asked for OCD, but any other like diagnosis or mental illnesses?
Mm-hmm. So OCD is one of those diagnoses that you generally do not, it's in that category of things that you generally don't diagnose under the age of 18. However, I have seen it diagnosed under the age of 18. Again, it's the sort of thing that it is supposed to, you're looking for a level of chronicness, you know, a long enough history, that the idea is that under 18 is not enough. You know, there's so many, they've gone through so many stages of development, so many changes, that you cannot accurately, truly, honestly document the level of the length of chronic time that you need to say that this we can attribute these symptoms to this. Because as soon as you say, oh yeah, this has been the issue for a year here, well, they're into another developmental stage. You know, they've gone from, you know, being a little kid to being a preteen. And then you say, well, it was a year here, but they turned from a preteen to a teenager. You know, they had a whole new hormone spurt there. So you will find the diagnosis under 18, but again, I am so skittish about certain diagnoses under the age of 18 because you're changing so much and so fast. The body is going through so many changes so fast, and the brain is going through so many changes so fast. And that is what the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual is taking into consideration when they're saying don't diagnose children with these things, because it's saying it is hard to attribute certain things to you know, you can't, it's hard to know what to attribute certain things to when you know you're going through developmental changes and you're going through hormonal changes and you're going through these things. But children absolutely, you know, can show, you know, so part of one of the things is, right, it's like some aspects of OCD might look like autism, for example. That sort of repetitive behaviors or hyper focus on one particular thing or that sort of hyper focus, that sort of repetitive behavior, that stereotypical behavior, those sorts of things. Well, that might be Asperger's or autism, you know, but you're calling it OCD, or, you know, just be ADHD, or you see what I'm saying? Like, it could be other things. And so, but yeah, they'll throw it out there. But if you got a doctor that's trying to tell you that your child has ODD OCD, or if you're concerned that it might be OCD, again, that's one of those things that I would say you want to talk to a psychologist and get some more in-depth assessments behind, and not just like a 1 hour, 2 hour, you know, assessment with a counselor like me. You need like somebody like, you know, Daryl, who, you know, as a psychologist would do, you know, 8 or 10 hours worth of testing and assessment, and, you know, something like that. That would be my recommendation.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you so much, Candace. We don't have time for any more questions, unfortunately, but I'm aware that we have had a couple of people asking. So if, Candace, you can stay for the hangout session for a little bit, then hopefully they can ask you. If you can't, that's absolutely fine. We don't expect you to, but if you can, that'd be great.
I'll hang out for a little bit.
Yeah, perfect. Candace, I really appreciate you kind of talking really frankly about the difference between bipolar and bipolar 2. It's actually something that I've personally been diagnosed with, bipolar 2, and it's kind of something that I kind of struggle talking about, because people may mistake it for like, oh, you're bipolar, and aren't you taking these heavy medications for that or something? But it's actually, you're the first person that I've met who's has a similar diagnosis to me.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's very different. It's actually very different from bipolar 1.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Like Amaya said, thank you so, so much. I'm really grateful to have you on again. Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, Healing, and Support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts, or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.